Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you all with us. We jump into our weekly conversation sound bites as we look at the food system in our lives and the future of our food system. We are joined here right now by Patty Lavera, who is Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch, where she coordinates the food team, and Vice President of Communications, where she's also Vice President, and Tom Super, who is Vice President of Communications for the National Chicken Council. And Patty and Tom, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on, Mark.
Patty, you there?
Yes.
Great. Good to have you back with us. We are going to jump into this arsenic debate, which we covered a little bit the other week here on our program when we looked at the report from Center for a Livable Future. And that report is saying that the report itself concluded that consuming arsenic-laden chicken, as it was said in the report, can increase our risk for lung and bladder cancer. And the Food and Water Watch report has also used this report as a way to, I hope I have this right, and if I don't, you'll correct me, Patty, sue the FDA for concealing records about arsenic in chicken food. And Tom Super, let me go to you first. Why does the Chicken Council saying this report, I read your statement, but I'll let you say it in your own words, why would this report should not be paid attention to?
Sure. Well, I'd first like to, question the actual headline that you stated. Arsenic-laden chicken is extremely misleading. This is an extremely small study. I think they tested about 120 chicken samples. We produce about 45 billion pounds of chicken every year, so it's not nearly indicative of all the chicken that we produce or eat. And the researchers did not use accepted and current risk calculations in their conclusions. Secondly, the tests were taken before this drug, Roxarsone, was pulled off the market, and currently no other arsenicals are used in raising broilers, so it is not an issue right now. And, even though we disagree with CLF scientific methods and how they draw their conclusions in this particular study, these levels are extremely, extremely tiny and in no way a public health threat, and your chicken is certainly not arsenic-laden. The levels they claim to have found are one-fifth of what EPA deems as safe in our drinking water, and they're 250 times less than the FDA tolerance level for arsenic in uncooked chicken.
So Patty, when we covered this a little bit a couple of weeks back, I'm curious as to, this is one of the arguments people made against the report, that it was a report using chicken that during a time when the Roxazone, which was the arsenic the arsenic addition to the feed, chicken feed, was being used. It's no longer being used, so this report is no longer relevant.
Well, we think that it is relevant for a couple of reasons. So, one, just for context, arsenic is something we don't need any exposure to, so any reduction we can make, we have to make. This is something we don't need to be exposed to even in tiny amounts, because over a lifetime of exposure, we're looking at things, including several types of cancer and heart disease and things like that. In terms of the relevance of this study, the folks at CLF were very open about the fact about when they bought those chickens, and what they were testing. They were testing product produced using this drug. And, the point that they're making is when you use that drug, we see residues in the meat that you're eating. We think that's a critical point, and it's critical because this drug, in most of the country, you can't use it in Maryland now because the law changed, but in the rest of the country, it's still allowed. It's just not being sold right now because the company that produced it voluntarily pulled it from the market because of some testing that FDA did. But FDA has not banned this drug, and so we're worried about what happens when, it's not being withheld from the market by the manufacturer. And what if they do want to bring it back? We think this data is important.
So, folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. I know a lot of us consume a lot of chicken. We enjoy it. So it really is something that we have to find what the underlying reality is. You can write us here at steinershow@gmail.com, log on to our Facebook page, tweet us at Mark Steiner. Again, Tom, one of the things is, the report did say, though, that, and let me just read this from the report, that was published in May 11, 2013, peer-reviewed by the Environmental Health Perspectives, that breast meat from conventionally produced chickens, which by law may receive arsenicals in their feed, had three times more inorganic arsenic than did the breast meat of USDA organic chickens, which may by law not receive arsenicals. The chicken was purchased between December 2010, June 2011, before Roxazone sales were suspended. And add to that that the manufacturers, Roxazone, I mean, could reinstitute Roxas Own whenever they want?
I'm sorry, what was the question, Mark?
So I'm just curious your response to that, and B, that Roxas Own itself could be reintroduced. It's not banned legally, so it could come back on the market whenever the industry thinks it's ready to come back.
Well, you know, I don't want to speak in hypotheticals, you know, should FDA say this come back or not. But currently the science just isn't there, you know, to ban it at the federal level. And, you know, since this drug was suspended in 2011, the FDA is currently examining all of the relevant scientific data regarding the use of arsenicals in all animals. And, you know, until that examination is completed, it would be premature to support or oppose a ban. You know, and you say that it's three times more in traditionally raised poultry. Again,
right.
we have to put this kind of into perspective. We're talking about what three times more is, 2.1 parts per billion, you know, versus zero or 0.8 parts per billion. You know, and I know Patty says that we need to reduce all, you know, arsenic. It's impossible to eliminate 100% from it for food. You know, it is everywhere. You know, chicken has a much lower level than many fruits, vegetables, fruit juices, rice, and some fish. And, you know, what we're talking about here, these parts per billion, one part per billion is equal to a drop of water in an Olympic-sized swimming pool, or 1.7 inches in relation to the circumference of the Earth. And again, these levels are hundreds of times below what is deemed as safe in food and drinking water.
Patty?
I mean, we have this conversation about a lot of exposures to things,
right,
whether it's, you know, environmental contaminants or, you know, in this case, a contaminant that we're, you know, putting in the food supply deliberately because we're feeding it to the chickens. So, you know, there is arsenic in our
food. But we're not feeding it to
the
chickens.
Well, right now, but it has been for a long time, for decades, this was deliberately fed to chickens. And this is one exposure that we can control. And so I don't think it's a matter of who is the biggest contributor to our diet. We know there's arsenic in the environment. We know there's arsenic in other foods. And we've gone lots of times to FDA to talk about those levels in juice and rice. And we talk to them about that, too, because there's things that can be done in those food supplies to reduce those exposures. But this is one that is very, you know, we can get our hands around and we can end this exposure by not using this drug anymore. And we have to take those opportunities when we're talking about something like arsenic that does have a long, you know, over a lifetime has known health effects. And I think the other thing that we need to talk about is that FDA is just woefully behind in figuring out these exposures and figuring out risk. So earlier, you know, you made a reference to the residue levels set by FDA. I mean, those were set in the 1950s and they haven't adjusted them. You know, we're really waiting for the FDA to figure this out. We're going to be waiting a long time. We do this with them on a lot of issues. This is something we can wrap our hands around and we can address and just say we don't need to use this drug anymore.
Well, let me ask you this direct question, Patty, and come back to Tom. And that if, in fact, and I'll come back to some other things we are using that Dr. Nachman raised in our conversation with him 2 weeks ago when this report about this report, and they had both your responses on it. But Food and Water Watch suing FDA for concealing records on arsenic in poultry feed. If, in fact, Roxas Own is not being used, what is Food and Water Watch suing for, and what are you trying to find out? And what do you think that is being withheld?
So we want to know the conversation that FDA – so FDA 2 years ago, just about 2 years ago, I think it was June, they put out results of testing that they did, and they found inorganic arsenic in the livers of chickens that were treated with arsenic-containing drugs. And that was what led – and the same day they announced those results, the subsidiary of Pfizer that made the drugs said they were voluntarily suspending sales of Roxas Own. So, and that's where we are now in terms of the regulatory arena. So we filed Freedom of Information Act requests and, you know, did all the things we're supposed to do through that process to try to figure out what was that communication like between the FDA and the manufacturer of the drug. Like, what were those conversations? Is there other data in there? What is the company thinking about the process if they wanted to bring this drug back to the market? And we've gotten nowhere, and we've asked FDA repeatedly. We've used the Freedom of Information Act process, and so that's what the lawsuit is about, to get other communication that may be happening about what is the status of this drug.
And so, I mean, what would your response to that, Tom? I mean, does that make sense to you, or does it make no sense?
Well, you know, I'm not going to comment on pending litigation, and I think that's a question more for FDA. than the National Chicken Council. From what I know, that the FDA is currently examining all of the relevant scientific data regarding the use of arsenicals in all animals, not just chickens. And for consumers, the bottom line is that right now that arsenicals are not fed to chickens raised for meat in the U.S.
So now what about the issue of, and one of the things he raised here as well, so I wanted both of you wanted to kind of comment on what he was saying, that he said that, I hope I pronounced this correctly, that Zoetis, Pfizer's pharmaceutical arm, currently sells a similar, they argue, arsenic-based drug, nitrazone, which is approved for use in chickens and turkeys. Eleanor White, who was the company spokesperson, said that nitrazone was not a substitute for roxazone, and scientific data supports its safety. So there's some big questions here that get raised. Is that important to us? Should it be important to us? How important are these? Is it that these similar products are on the market? I think that the issues you raise, and there's nobody here to respond to that. Tom, let me let you start and go to Patty.
Sure. That drug is not used in raising broiler chickens. So roxazone and nitrazone are used to treat two different things. So kind of let me back up and explain why roxazone was used in the first place. It does contain an arsenical compound, and it's very effective at killing and preventing parasite growth in the chicken's intestines. These parasites are called cocci. And what they do, if they grow and they're able to enter the chicken's intestines, it forms a disease called coccidiosis. It's very devastating to chicken flocks. It's akin to giving your dog or your cat heartworm medicine to prevent those parasites from growing inside. Now, nitrazone is primarily used in turkey production, I believe, to treat to prevent a disease called blackhead, which is also a disease called by parasites, I believe, in the intestine. I don't think it has anything to do with their actual head. And I think that they depend on it as a preventative, and it's given to the turkeys in the first few weeks of their life and used more heavily during the summer months in turkey production. But again, it's not used in raising chickens that are intended for meat consumption.
Patty, I mean, have you been looking at this as well?
Well, it's one of the things we're trying to get a handle on, just like you heard from Dr. Nachman a few weeks ago. We don't get great information about this from FDA. They really don't track who's using these drugs for what purposes. That's one of the many gaps that we have in our understanding. And so we're just concerned that that folks will maybe experiment with trying to use this as a substitute. And, the other reason that roxazone was used for a long time was supposedly for growth promotion and to make the meat of the chicken appear pinker. So it's not always as clear as what's written in the applications and what's on the books. And so we're worried about this becoming kind of a substitute that's still, introducing arsenic into the system.
So the question becomes, Patty, I mean, I think that, all right, there are two things that pop in people's heads as I listen to this conversation. I've gotten some emails about this and people knew it was coming up. But one of the emails I received earlier questioned why are we concerned about this? Is there any real proof that any of this affects us? That this is to keep chickens healthy that we buy at a local supermarket. Why to even be concerned that these parts are so small and people kind of have a hard time putting their hands around why there's such a deep concern?
Is that for me?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Patty. Yeah.
I mean, when we're talking about, when we're talking about diseases and we're talking about diseases that happen over because of long-term exposures, these are the levels we are often talking about. It doesn't take massive doses of a lot of things to interfere with health and to cause, different problems. So for one reference point, the Environmental Protection Agency, and they even say this level is too high. They admit that the risk caused by the level they set for drinking water, which is 10 parts per billion, which is a tiny amount of arsenic, is still too high for what their goal normally is for preventing cancer. So this is the realm we're in when we're talking about exposures to things that interfere, whether it's a cancer risk or it's interfering with endocrine systems and talking about things like diabetes. And so that's where we are often, and we're talking about a food that people eat a lot of. And, you know, what we just saw in the paper that the folks at Johns Hopkins put out was that there is an exposure when this drug is used. So, and this is an exposure that we know how to end. And so all of those things combined, we think, make it a really important issue to focus on.
Are there things that you're concerned about, Tom, that the industry should be concerned about that we're not focusing on here? I mean, are we saying that everything we're using is fine, that using levels of arsenic and other things in the feed that we don't know, since it's all proprietary information, as we learn from our conversations in depth with folks at Purdue and other places, that's not something that the consumer should be concerned about at all?
No, I don't think they should be concerned about it. You know, even though we disagreed with the FDA's assessment of this drug back in 2011, consumers, your listeners should know that there are no longer any arsenicals fed to chickens raised for meat. You know, and the bottom line, you're talking about very small amounts, exposure over time. The best advice is what your grandmother told you. Eat plenty of fruits and vegetables. Eat a balanced variety diet. Follow the U.S. dietary guidelines. Eat, you know, lean protein, you know, which should definitely include chicken as a healthy part of a balanced diet. And get outside and exercise. You know, it sounds very simple, but, you know, those are the messages that your grandmother told you growing up, and those still hold true today, and you know, you'll be fine.
So just to kind of conclude this, Patty, I think this is the beginning of what I think is a larger discussion just about what's in our food. And I think that if people do, as I said to you earlier, are concerned about this but don't know where to go, the information is not there. I think that people – and who I respect at Purdue and other places were saying it's not to be concerned about, even though all the stuff information is proprietary inside of what's in their feed or anybody else's feed. And if there really is no smoking gun, so to speak, because we don't have any actual data that says, no, if we consume these pesticides, it's going to do thus and so to us. I mean, that's where the disconnect happens.
Right, and this is one of the dilemmas for consumers who are trying to make good choices. Is that we often have a gap between you know, what we know and what is happening. So this is why people need to get involved in what the regulations are for food, because often that's what's in play more than the information they get to decide for themselves. In the short term, they can call the companies and look at the websites of the companies they're buying from. I mean, one other point that I should have mentioned earlier is that this is not entirely just about the chicken that we're eating. This is also about the environment where those chickens are raised. And in Maryland, you raise a lot of chickens. You know, whether or not the arsenic stays in the meat, if it doesn't, it's probably coming out in the waste from the chicken, and then we're leaving that in the environment of where you raise those chickens. And that doesn't necessarily stay put. It can get into water, et cetera. So we may be exposing people in a different way. So it's just one more reason to not put this into the system in the first place. And that's not necessarily something we can all do as individuals. It's something we have to do to really change how that system's working.
So before we go to our next conversation, let's go to a caller coming in. Alan?
Hello?
Alan, you're on the air.
Yeah, I don't want even minuscule amounts of poison in my food. You know, listen to this argument. My old man used to say, Wonder Bread don't put up with that kind of baloney. I grew up reading Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. So, you know, I don't want even minuscule amounts of anything that wasn't in the chicken before the chicken was slaughtered, except for positive things. What's up with this hogwash? And that's all I have to say. We have a right to clean food and clean air. And, you know, and to haggle about minuscule amounts is, you know, just baloney.
All right, thank you so much, Alan. Let's get a closing thought here. Tom, why don't you lead off, and then Patty, close out.
Yeah, look, I would say just to your caller, you know, I know that it's arsenic is a scary word when you hear it, but it is a naturally occurring element in our environment that is widely distributed within the Earth's soil, air, and water, and to completely eliminate it from our food supply is just impossible to do. You know, and I would say just on a concluding note that, you know, this is a very extremely small study. It's of no health concern, and consumers should continue to eat chicken, whichever, you know, production method that they choose to spend their food dollars on, with confidence in its safety and its nutritional value.
Patty Levera.
I think that there, I mean, we don't disagree there's arsenic everywhere, but we don't have to make it worse. We don't have to add exposures. And this is a food that we know how to end this exposure from. So right now it's not being used. That's a good thing, and we want to make that permanent. And that's where changing the rules really come in. This is something we don't need to be adding to the food supply, and then we can go tackle other exposures next.
Thank you both so much. This has been really an interesting discussion. We'll do more of these. Pat Lavera is the System Director of Food and Water Watch, where she coordinates the food team. Tom Super is Vice President of Communications for the National Chicken Council. And Tom Super, Pat Lavera, thank you both so much.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
We're going to take a 10-second break. Don't go away. We're going to come back with a different discussion. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We are starting a new part of our program here on Soundbites here on WEAA-FM and Delmarva Public Radio. And it's we're going to call it Monsanto Watch. And we've asked Monsanto to come on. They haven't said yes yet, but we're looking for others to come on as well who support all of that work, and they will be coming in the coming weeks. Right now we're talking with Tom Laskaway, who's food and ag writer at Grist, executive director of Food and Environment Reporting Network, and wrote a piece in Grist, which we'll be linking to as well as to the Grist site, called Gut Punch. Monsanto could be destroying your microbiome. Tom, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Mark. Thanks for having me.
And it is Laskaway, right? I have
that
right?
That's correct. You've got it right.
I want to make sure. So, Tom, what does that mean?
Well, you know, it's a complicated story. I mean, Roundup.
It is. I was being smiling a bit, but I know it's very complicated. What does that mean?
It's true. So Monsanto produces a herbicide known as Roundup, which most people are probably familiar with because they sell it for consumers to put on their yards, as well as it's used in huge amounts in agriculture. It's also the centerpiece of Monsanto's genetically engineered product line known as the Roundup Ready seeds, which are seeds that are engineered to tolerate application of this herbicide. Well, of course, I think most people are now familiar with the fact that these seeds have become ubiquitous. You know, worldwide, something like 80 or 90% of corn, soy, and cotton, and also sugar beets here in the U.S., are grown from seeds with these genetically engineered traits. And that's a lot of Roundup being applied to acres and acres of land in the U.S. Now, what that, of course, means is some of that Roundup is remaining on the food because typically, before Monsanto came up with these genetically engineered seeds, you couldn't put Roundup on fields with plants that you were going to harvest. It's very effective at killing just about any plant. But with these seeds, you're able to apply it to the plants themselves, and then they fruit, you know, and the ears of corn come, and these are harvested, and there is residue of this of Roundup, or more specifically, its active ingredient called glyphosate that remains on the food. As a result of this, we're consuming more of it, and it raises the question of, is there any effect on us from consuming this chemical? Now, glyphosate has a reputation of being the safest herbicide almost ever invented. The line that's commonly used with it is it's less toxic than aspirin.
Right.
Now, the reason for that is that glyphosate affects plants, a very specific biochemical process in plants, and it's a biochemical process that we don't possess. So it can't possibly be affecting us because we don't have this particular chain of reactions in our bodies. However, glyphosate does affect microbes who happen to have this particular biochemical process, and many of those microbes are beneficial microbes in our bodies. Now, a lot of this is speculative because this really isn't something that people have been looking at, that scientists haven't really been looking at potential effects on this order for humans, and even if there were, they would be subtle and hard to pick out.
So, Tom, let me see. I'm going to interrupt. We take a very brief break. We're going to come right back and pick up where you just left off here.
Sure.
This is important. We really have to explore why we don't know these things and what the science is not telling us and what has to happen to understand this. We'll come right back. Tom Laskaway about his piece gut punch, Monsanto could be destroying your microbiome. Stay with us. This is Mark Steiner. We're here on Soundbites, here on the Mark Steiner Show, heard here on WEAA-FM in Baltimore and over in Salisbury, Maryland, Delmarva Public Radio, our sister station. We're here with Tom Laskaway, food and ag writer at Grist, executive director of Food and Environmental Reporting Network, and talking about the article in Grist he wrote called Gut Punch, Monsanto Could Be Destroying Your Microbiome, and concluding up with our conversation, we wanted to kind of jump right into what you were saying, which is this is the part that I think that is scariest that you are raising, Tom, is that for people is because we really don't know about these things, nor know really what happens inside our bodies often and what affects them. And what you're arguing here in this piece about these intestinal flora herbicides hitting our guts, hitting this bacteria in our guts, that could actually destroy our immune system. So talk about what could be happening and why we don't really know what's happening and why the research isn't there.
Sure. I mean, the piece of research that I focused on that I found kind of intriguing about all this is just some work out of Germany where they looked at cows who actually tend to ingest a fair amount of Roundup because they're eating feed that has been treated with it. They're eating corn feed that has been treated with it when the corn was being grown. So there are a lot of residues there. And they found that Roundup was more harmful to the beneficial bacteria inside cows and less harmful to the pathogens inside cows, in particular a form of botulism. And they were speculating that this could be causing a current epidemic of botulism, which actually exists in cows. The point being this differential effect, right? Glyphosate's hurting the good bugs more than it's hurting the bad bugs. And if it's happening in cattle, it's entirely possible that it could happen in humans. The thing is, nobody's looking to see the real levels of glyphosate exposure that we're experiencing, and no one's really done the research to see what effect glyphosate specifically has on the human's population of gut bacteria. The reason is it's expensive kind of work to do. Even the government does not test for glyphosate residue on our food. There's one. They test actually one crop. They look at soybeans every year and see how much glyphosate is on soybeans that have been harvested and prepared for sale. That's it. But glyphosate is, of course, used on many, many crops that are grown in the U.S. and on fields, even on non-Roundup-ready fields. They're used before the planting to clear out the weeds. So it's really an open question how much we're being exposed to glyphosate. Historically, the line is it's okay. It all goes out in urine. We really absorb very little. And the focus of its harm has always been, well, how much, if you drink a glass of glyphosate, how much glyphosate would you have to drink to make you sick? That's the kind of focus on how the toxic, chemical safety is done in the U.S. It's not looking at what kind of chronic effects or subtle effects a chemical might have from a low-level exposure over years and years.
So finally, before we bring Tom Philpott in to talk about the politics behind all of this and where it came from in the beginning, this is something that, as you say, we use 200 million pounds of these glyphosate every year.
Just in the U.S.
And the U.S. Department of Agriculture doesn't track it. And the power of Monsanto inside government is one of the reasons it doesn't track it. And that's this is the insidiousness that you're talking about.
Right, and I think it's also important to look at how toxic chemicals are regulated generally in this country, because the presumption is that chemicals are safe until they're proven dangerous. Typically, you're not proving it dangerous until it's been out in the wild, as they say, for years and years and years. And we have tens of thousands of chemicals like that. And so right now the government actually doesn't have a lot of legal precedent to go in and tell a company, you know, prove to us this chemical is safe. Typically the company will say, here's how much it'll poison you. Less than that is safe, and we're going to sell it. And the government says, okay. And that applies to all these pesticides, including glyphosate.
Well, this is just the beginning of this conversation. Tom Laskaway, I really enjoy your writing. I appreciate you being part of the show today.
Thanks so much.
And we'll come back to having you on our Monsanto roundtables. Maybe we'll get you on there with some of their pro-Monsanto people so we can have a good roaring discussion.
Fantastic. I look forward to it.
Me too. Tom Laskaway, food and ag writer for Grist. We connect to his article, Gut Punch, on our website, standardshow.org. He's also executive director of the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Tom, once again, thank you. And let's go to our other Tom, who joins us here on the show right now. And Tom Philpott joins us once again. Tom, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
How are you doing?
Doing all right.
So, Tom, let's jump into this piece that you wrote, which I found really interesting about about the origins of the power of Monsanto, its connections to a presidential candidate and the investment company that he ran. You wrote an article about Mitt Romney.
Oh, right, Mitt Romney a while back, sure.
Right, right.
Sorry about that. Monsanto, starting in the 40s or so, going into the 70s, was a chemical company, and it produced industrial chemicals, and it produced some of the most toxic industrial chemicals that have ever been used. And it also, in addition to that, got involved with the war effort in Vietnam and produced napalm, and was also a producer of Agent Orange. And so this company, flash forward into the 80s, this company has a terrible reputation. It's denounced by environmentalists. It's got a record of, poisoning water, all the problems associated with Agent Orange in Vietnam. And it's got this promising technology that it's working on the side of genetically modifying, plants and seeds. And so it's kind of an innovator in that. But really that was a side project for this, for its greater business. And it took a consulting firm in Boston called Bain Management for advice on what to do. And a young consultant named Mitt Romney quickly got on the case and was involved with Monsanto starting in the early 80s. And, Bain was one of the forces that pushed Monsanto into, moving away from this past as this kind of old school chemical company like, Dow or something, and throwing its lot in with GMOs. And it was kind of a public relations move in a lot of ways, but that was the idea, that it would ditch this and go into this clean, green, new world of GMO technology.
But in some ways, one of the things you wrote about, I think that kind of plays into what we're going to talk about your article about wheat in Oregon, but also plays off of what our last guest Tom Laskaway was saying about what we don't know about, is that this really was what people are arguing is where the power of Monsanto kind of really literally entered the kind of physical structure of agriculture and government and policymaking.
Right. I mean, they had to make, when you're a company like that, when you're a company that makes products traditionally that have been toxic and controversial, it definitely makes sense strategy to make political friends. They have friends in the agencies, and they obviously, our story that we just told just stopped in the 80s, but obviously as they shifted into GMOs, they continued the strategy of cultivating friends in the regulatory agencies like the FDA, USDA, EPA, and, you know, got a, you know, by any objective reckoning, they had a very easy ride for GMOs in the regulatory world. It does not take that much, really, to get a new GMO on the market. There's not very much testing. I'm sure Tom talked about that. But testing that does get done is done by the company. And, you know, that was all about, you know, making friends in Washington.
I mean, and I do want to jump into the wheat piece here as we have time. But, I mean, because many more former Monsanto employees, allies, hold huge positions in the U.S. government, even ties on the Supreme Court. And that's the kind of stuff that kind of affects things like the research, whether it's done or not done, on the products they put out, but also on what happened in Oregon that you wrote about with a GM, genetically modified wheat they were just testing that blew off into other people's fields. We think blew off.
Right. And I think, you know, the really important thing there is that the public basically, you know, all the, like I pointed out in my piece, all the major GMO crops, cotton, corn, soy, these crops aren't generally consumed directly by people. Cotton obviously goes into clothes. Corn and soy are mainly animal feed and energy crops. They go into, you know, literally into car fuel. Very little of them are consumed directly by human beings. And so it's this abstraction a little bit with those crops. With wheat is something it's number one use. You know, bread is the staff of life. We're a bread culture, even with this sort of anti-carb, anti-flour backlash that we're on. You know, people still consume a lot of bread. So you got this crop that's directly consumed by people. And, you know, Monsanto was very interested in, you know, dominating that market and tried through the, you know, the late 90s and early 2000s to come up with a GMO wheat, and they succeeded, but the pushback was really strong, both here in the United States and especially in Europe, where a lot of our wheat goes, that the European public was not going to accept GMO wheat. And because of that controversy, Monsanto took a step back and said, okay, we're not going to do this. And, you know, American wheat producers said, we don't want it because it's going to mess up our access to foreign export markets. And so Monsanto pulled back in, you know, 2004, 2005. And Oregon, the last test that I know about was in 2001. And, you know, fast forward to a couple weeks ago, and, you know, a farmer there discovers in his field wheat that cannot be killed by this Monsanto herbicide Roundup. And tests confirmed that it was, in fact, engineered to withstand Roundup. And yeah, it's a big mystery as to how it got there, but it's there. And you know, the thing about plants is that they don't contain themselves. They produce pollen. The pollen gets carried by wind. Pollen from one wheat crop will blow to another crop, insert its genes there. And you know, we still haven't figured out exactly what happened, but you know, that GMO strain of wheat is still out there after, you know, 10 years of not being used, supposedly. I mean, you know, who knows exactly what happened?
So, and I just as you conclude all of this, I mean, I wonder what you – there are a lot of missing pieces. I know you're going to be covering Monsanto in some depth as the weeks and months in the next weeks and months. But,
sure.
I mean, I think that this particular piece about the wheat blowing over kind of directly relates to the Supreme Court case in many ways that just happened.
Yeah,
and the whole question of who controls the genetics of our food.
Yeah. I mean, you know, interestingly, so this farmer in Oregon discovers this wheat. He doesn't want it. He doesn't want Roundup Ready wheat. So he contacts the authorities, and there's this investigation. But on the other hand, Monsanto could theoretically say, and they're not doing this because it would be really pushing things, but they could theoretically say, hey, wait a minute, what is our gene doing on your field? And, you know, sue him for not having a license, not having paid for a license for it. Theoretically, in the law, they could do that. And that is an extremely dangerous thing. That if you're a corn farmer, say, and corn cross-pollinates way more easily than wheat. So say you're a corn farmer and you're doing organic wheat in your field, and your neighbor's doing GMO wheat, and his wheat cross-pollinates yours, and you've got, you know, this licensed, patented gene in your field all of a sudden, you could be held liable. Even though you've been damaged, you've just lost your organic certification because GMOs aren't allowed in organic certification, and you're now carrying their gene in your field, and you could be sued for, you know, patent infringement. And, the legal structure, organic farmers have been asking for legal protection to get damages if their crops are contaminated with GMOs, and the regulatory agencies have not seen fit to give them that power. And I don't know how that would go in court. I don't know if that's been tested in court. But what has been tested is these extremely strong patent protections for these biotech companies.
Tom Philpott, we look forward to getting you back here on Monsanto Watch and really getting into some serious discussions and debates with agricultural professors around the country around these issues to really kind of lay them all on the table, because I think that it is really about the future of our food system is all built around large companies like Monsanto and where we're going to end up going. And I appreciate the work you've been doing. Tom Philpott is food and ag blogger for Mother Jones, a co-founder of Maverick Farms in North Carolina. And it's always a pleasure to have him with us here on Soundbites. Tom, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
We'll talk very soon.
All right.
Here on Soundbites, we're about to talk once again with Blaine Snipstall, who was on last week. He's farm manager at Fire Seeds Farm and Apiary. And Blaine, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Please, brother. Good to be back.
I know you couldn't get in studio today because you're out to do your CSA.
That's right.
So you're busy on the farm?
Yeah, we have a lot going on. We have the CSA. We got 5 markets to service.
Wow.
And we had some people come up to the farm today, so I just couldn't get away.
That's cool. So, Blaine, let's start with one of the things you were doing. We talked the last couple of times you were on the show with us. There was this poem you were going to read, Freedom's Plow.
That's right.
Did you have it with you?
I do.
So let's start with that and then pick up why you wanted to read this poem by Langston Hughes, this piece of the poem, and what it means to you. But let me let you share it with our listeners first. Go ahead.
Okay.
Reading from the field, which is only appropriate, right?
Right. I'm under the tree line right now. Okay, I'll read these the last 2 excerpts.
Okay.
Keep your hand on the plow. Hold on. If the house is not yet finished, don't be discouraged, builder. If the fight is not yet won, don't be wary, soldier. The plan and the pattern is here, woven from the beginning. Into the warp and woof of America. All men are created equal. No man nor woman is good enough to govern another man nor woman without that other's consent. Better die free than to live slaves. Who said those things? Americans. Who owns those words? America. Who is America? You. Me. We are America. To the enemy who would conquer us from without, we say no. To the enemy who would divide and conquer us from within, we say no. Freedom, brotherhood, democracy. To all the enemies of these great words, we say no. A long time ago, an enslaved people heading toward freedom made up a song. Keep your hand on the plow. Hold on. The plow plowed a new furrow across the field of history. Into that furrow, the freedom seed was dropped. From that seed, a tree grew, is growing, will ever grow. That tree is for everybody, for all America, for all the world. May its branches spread and its shelter grow until all races and all peoples know its shade. Keep your hand on the plow. Hold on.
So tell me, Blaine, why that piece was so important to you, especially in terms of you being a farmer and you're being an African-American farmer. What is that saying to you and the rest of us?
Well, you know, the title of the poem is Freedom's Plow, and it's written by Langston Hughes, who is considered one of the leaders of the Harlem Renaissance, you know, behind Claude McLay and other folks. You know, and to me and for Denzel as well, you know, being black farmers in this context and coming across this poem, Freedom's Plow, it really locates, you know, the centrality of working with the land within the process of freedom and emancipation, not just today, but historically, you know, that at the time of Reconstruction, during up and through the 1920s and the dawn of the Harlem Renaissance, the agrarian, the rural, the land-based dynamic was still so very prevalent, that so much so that an urban author like Langston Hughes highlighted it in many of his poems, and including this one. So, you know, when we came across this, we thought this would highlight, you know, our current context, you know, that there's still a very large urban dynamic, but closer to the center are folks like us, all farmers, farmers of color, people that work the land in various different forms.
And so when you think about that, that he wrote back in the 1930s, and so here we are now in 2013, and I know you're a huge advocate of people going back to the land and working. So how does that speak to young people now when they hear? What do you want to say to them about this?
You know, there's other excerpts in there that you know, the poem's quite long.
It is long, yes.
But, you know, what I say to younger folks is, you know, is that we have to believe in our dreams, and that our dreams are things not just to think about, but to create, you know, and working outside and working with the land. And you don't have to be a farmer. You don't have to be a farm worker. You know, there are myriad of other things, you know, individuals can do. But there is a quality to being outside and working with other people closely that is, in certain regards, unparalleled in other places. So I would say, you know, to young folks, because I'm part of that generation, you know, come out to the farm, you know, and, you know, in larger part, you know, we have a duty, we have an obligation, you know, and we have a right to agitate society in a certain direction that we feel would be greater than the moment in which we're in now, that can push us closer to being closer to our fuller selves, to accessing all the divine potential that everybody has, independent of or irregardless of one's culture, race, or ethnicity. As young people, we have a duty and a right to essentially further the revolutionary process that our ancestors had initiated centuries, decades ago.
And I want to add, that was very well put, Blaine, and I appreciate you being part of the show. And I was thinking about what you were just saying and how Morgan State University students actually came out to the farm and did some work with you all.
Yeah, it was a beautiful thing. And I tell you, these we have these two folks in particular, Miss Aaliyah and Mr. Jack. Jack was on the show last week, and they're absolutely soldiers of light, and they're bringing out tons of Morgan State students, tons of young folks, and exposing them to agriculture and to working outside. And, you know, we've had doctors, lawyers, technicians, IT folks, business folks come up here. You know, we're not proselytizing or converting anybody, but, you know, through their experience, each person is saying, it's like, oh, wow, I'm beginning to realize how I intersect with the food system, how I can make access into changing, you know, our health, our nutrition, the way things function, you know, and they're doing it from their own lenses, which is very powerful.
Blaine Snipstall, who is farm manager for Five Seeds Farm and Apiary. Blaine, thank you so much for taking time today in the midst of your preparing for all your CSAs and farmers markets. I appreciate it.
Appreciate you, brother.
Thank you very much. Right. Blaine Snipstall, we'll share that poem online as well, so you can next read the entire Langston Hughes poem on our webpage at steinershow.org. And that's it for the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites today. I appreciate you all being part of this program today. On Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Malbronis, and Mark Gunnery. We're engineered by Christopher Rank at Public Radio Delmarva. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. For Delmarva Public Radio and On Delmarva, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.